wrong with that?
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get the Senate Committee on Judiciary open. We have a number of bills for public hearing and possible work sessions. What we're going to do is start off with, I have two members here, and they need to get back to their task. So the first bill I'm going to open up is for House Bill 3474.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3474 increases processing fee charged to employee by employee for garnishing employees' wages.
Stiegler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3474 is the result of a conversation I had with a local small business owner, and originally, back I believe it was in 2001, the original legislation was passed by this body allowing an employer to assess a $1 fee per week of wages or partial week of wages paid for the basically for the processing of the wage garnishment. And it was a small token of I guess giving the employer some ability to recoup some of the expenses that they incur in that process. When an employer processes a wage garnishment, it not only takes extra time, but it takes extra paperwork as well. There's a reporting process. This fee goes into play only after the garnishment is actually collected. So the fee doesn't get collected itself until the garnishment is paid in full. And all I did in this process, the inquiry came to me from a local business person who, you know, said, you know, it's not that I mind doing these. Obviously, they need to be done. I'm doing a favor for other, you know, people that have a debt owed to them, another business, whatever. And I don't mind doing them. It just takes me extra time and extra money in bookkeeping fees and that kind of thing. So I did some research and found that, indeed, this body had passed legislation some time before. And what I did was go back and talk to some folks at the Oregon Restaurant Association, some of the business lobby, and ask if they would be opposed to an increase in that to a $2 per week fee. So essentially what this does is it bumps up the potential fee that could be charged in a full year of garnishments, if there was a wage garnishment that went on for a year, to $104 from $52, which isn't a heck of a lot. There was no opposition. Most of those business entities either were neutral or, indeed, you have before you today a letter from the Oregon Business Association that they prepared for the hearing in the House side, and they, in fact, support the effort to increase that fee. So it's a simple little bill that, again, it's just a modicum of recognition to what oftentimes are small businesses out there who are doing work for others to collect a lawful debt on the part of for other businesses and other creditors. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Representative Stewart? All right, well, thank you very much. Let me see if there was anyone else who wanted to give testimony on the House Bill 3474. Not seeing anyone, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing. And colleagues, I'm ready to go open a work session on House Bill 3474.
Mr. Chair, move HB 3474 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 3474 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Sure.
Any objection?
No objection, Mr. Chair, but just a comment for the record, conflict of interest. I own a small business, and we do have people with garnishments, but we do not collect a fee.
All right. Any other comments? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Wissett, will you carry this one? And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 3474. And opening a public hearing on House Bill 2453A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2453A extends the attorney-client privilege to include an agent of the client. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Representative Barton, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
I'm Brent Barton. I represent House District 51, which is East Clackamas County. And I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for hearing actually three of my bills this morning. This is the only one I plan to testify to. I hope you will find them as easy and non-controversial as we did on the other side. I'm cautiously optimistic. House Bill 2453 really is a very minor adjustment in law, and there's one point I would like to drive home. It is my strong opinion that this bill only adjusts the law to conform with what is already current practice throughout the law. It is my opinion that the vast majority of the bar already believes the law currently to reflect what this bill will do. This bill will essentially bring Oregon in conformity with the Uniform Evidence Code, which is in with respect to the definition of representative of a client. Now, let me explain, if I may, what this is. It is literally just the representative of a client of, say, a corporation. I, as many of you know, am a lawyer at Perkins Coie. We represent many corporate clientele. Representative of a client is who within the corporation, say Corporation A, which people within that corporation are entitled to have privileged communications with counsel. For kind of an interesting historical reason, and I'd be happy to explain it to you if on questioning if this committee is interested, Oregon has a totally unique, I like to think of it as a quirk, in the definition of representative of a client. And this is the only one in American law quite like it. And this quirk has potentially real consequences in two common situations. Actually, the common one would be independent contractor, because a strict reading of Oregon law as is would say that an independent contractor of a corporation is never entitled to have privileged communications with counsel. Now, the world really could not function that way, and that's why I say that this bill, I would say, brings the statutory law into conformity with what is common practice. And examples of independent contractors who frequently have to have privileged communications with counsel would be, for example, a contract lobbyist. Oftentimes, a contract lobbyist is in charge, particularly of inherently political organizations, have to have privileged communication with counsel to formulate effective political and legal strategy on behalf of their clients. It could be argued that actually at this point in time, a contract lobbyist is never entitled to a privileged communication with their client's counsel. Another example would be in certain mergers and acquisitions, particularly smaller businesses that often don't have the in-house expertise to negotiate a complex merger or acquisition. They often will bring in a consultant to negotiate a deal. And in that case, it's potentially at very heart of the company's existence is the ability for that independent contractor to have privileged communications with the client's counsel. So that is why I bring this bill forward. The bill, as originally drafted, had some potential unintended consequences. I've been working with various stakeholders. I believe at this time there is no opposition to the bill.
All right, thank you. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Unfortunately, I don't have my staff measure summary, but I was barring the good senator to my right, and it indicates that there was a considerable amount of people who voted against it, including the sponsors of the bill.
Oh, no, this is the wrong one.
We got the wrong staff.
The packet this morning had the wrong insert, so you're looking at one that we did last week.
We did, yes.
Okay, so I'm a fool.
No, we both are, because it's transposed the numbers.
Thank you. You relied on the
We did 2353.
To my right. I want you to know, to my right.
Well, Chair and Vice Chair Boquist, if I, for a moment, I thought I was a fool.
No, I will ask one question to make sure I understand. What we're trying to do is close the loophole. So hypothetically, the subcontractors that I use in my contracting that rely on our legal counsel would now be covered in the state of Oregon. So basically what we're doing, right?
Same type. Chair Pozanski, I'm sorry, Vice Chair Boquist, can you repeat the question? It went a little fast. I didn't catch it.
Talking about contract lobbyists, but likewise, subcontractors I use with my company that use our legal counsel for contractual purposes would then be covered under that privilege thing.
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Boquist, potentially.
Yep.
It depends on if they meet the definition of representative of client covered in the bill. They would have to meet certain criteria, i.e. if they have the authorization and thus and really rely on that legal advice to do their job that you've retained them to do, then yes, they would be covered. Whereas currently, they would not be.
All right, thank you.
Senator Westad.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Representative Burton, what happens if the employee is a relative or a family member of the principal officer or director?
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Whitsett, I don't know that that would be relevant to the privilege analysis under representative of client. I still think they would have to meet the criteria in this bill would propose, also in the Uniform Evidence Code. Now, it is possible, let's pretend that they're a relative of a principal. I mean, there might implicate other privileges, such as spousal privilege and other privileges, but that would be a separate analysis, nor I don't think it's relevant to this bill that I can see off the top of my head.
Thank you.
All right. So any other questions? Oh. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2453? Not seeing anyone. We'll close the public hearing. And we're going to go ahead and open up for a work session on House Bill 2453.
Mr. Chair, HB 2453 to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Broquist moves House Bill 2453A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonamici.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just for purposes of disclosure, I do this when Perkins Coie shows up in our committee. Representative Barton works with my husband, and I just want to put that on the record, although I assure you that will not influence the way I vote on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hey, Mr. Chair, conflict of interest. I own a business that retains counsel and would be immediately impacted by this bill.
All right. Any other concerns, comments? Any objection to the motion? Not seeing any, so order, and
I'll carry it, Mr. Chair. That way I can remember my conflict of interest.
All right, Senator Boquist will be our carrier. We'll close the public hearing and, work session on House Bill 2453A, and should we go ahead and go back to the top? All right, so we're going to go ahead and go back to the top of our agenda and I'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2789A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2789A clarifies the definition of parole and probation officers for the purposes of carrying firearms. It provides that retired parole and probation officers are exempt from being prosecuted for unlawful possession of firearms. It declares emergency effective upon passage. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact, no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian DeLeishman. I'm here representing the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, as well as the Oregon Council of Police Associations. Your staff has actually given you a very good summary of what the bill does. We believe it fixes two technical things in statute. We had a situation arise in two counties in which the counties and the parole and probation officers wanted to be able to have parole and probation officers that had not served a full year and were fully certified, but already had passed their firearms training from DPSST. Those counties, along as I indicated, along with FOPO, were liking to, or willing to have those people, parole and probation officers, carry firearms, as did the rest of the parole and probation officers in those counties. We checked with DPSST. They believe the current statute is clear that in fact, should have been allowed. The counties did not check with DPSST. They're in the room. We felt it was helpful just to clarify it for the sake of those counties understanding that you either if you're certified or you have passed the DPSST firearms training, that in fact you can carry a firearm. The second piece of the bill deals with retired parole and probation officers. Current statute allows a sheriff, constable, marshal, police officer, whether active or honorably retired, to carry a firearm. This just expands it so that you can be a retired parole and probation officer as long as you're in good standing and have continued to be certified to carry a firearm through DPSST, that you can carry a firearm after you've retired. Obviously, the need for that, and these parole and probation officers can address it even further if you need additional information. But it's a dangerous job while you're on the job, but you also run into people after you've retired that you have encountered during your lifetime of service, and the need for that protection is pretty basic. Thank you.
Whoever wants to go next.
Good morning, Senator Prezansky and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Sattel. I am a parole and probation officer, first of all, with Yamhill County. I've been a parole officer with Yamhill County for 20 years now. I'm also the chair of the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, otherwise known as FOPO. To be honest with you, I can't remember how long I've been the chair of that organization. I think it's been about 8 years. I have submitted some written testimony, and that's much longer than what I'll say to you this morning. I realize you have a very long morning scheduled. I just wanted to note that we look at ourselves as parole and probation officers as kind of the behind-the-scenes law enforcement for the state of Oregon. We're out there in the communities, and in most cases, people don't know who we are or what we are doing. But one of the things that we are doing every single day is we are in the homes of convicted felons. We're there to make sure that, one, they live there, and two, that they're abiding by the conditions of their supervision. That's the conditions of their probation or the conditions ordered by the Board of Parole and the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. Oftentimes, while we're in the homes, we will run across violations, and we will have to act immediately as far as whether making a decision whether or not we want to take these folks into custody. On the other hand, sometimes we walk into homes and we don't know that there are violations happening, but the offender does, and that makes them nervous, and it makes them more likely to act out violently towards us. So it's very important that we have that ability to protect ourselves. And the statute that allows for arming does just that. But because of this loophole, and as you've seen in here, we're only asking that the word or be added into the definition, because right now if we combine two different statutes, it does make it a little shaky as far as the definition, and some counties have opted not to allow those POs to be armed. I like to relate it to saying it would be silly to send police officers out into the community every day but not allow them to carry a gun for the first year. Oftentimes, what we do is far more dangerous than what the police officers do, because every person we deal with is a convicted felon, and we are in those folks' homes. And I would just close with the fact that, to my knowledge, of the 36 counties in the state of Oregon, I only know of one county that does not require their adult parole and probation officers to do home visits on their highest risk offenders. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Bill Broughton, and I think he can tell you a little bit more of his experience and also speak to the retirement piece as far as arming and qualifications.
Chair and Senate committee members, I have to apologize. I'm getting over the flu, so I have the sniffles as well.
Just keep the distance. That's all we ask.
Yes, sir. My name is Deputy Broughton. I've been an employee with Marion County Sheriff's Office for 15 years. The first 14 years was as a corrections deputy, where I was afforded, under the current language of the state statute, the ability to carry a firearm both on and off duty, and at the time of retirement, continue to carry that firearm through my retirement benefits. Last year, I left the Corrections Division of the Sheriff's Office and became a parole and probation officer at Marion County. And thankfully, Marion County does recognize the statute as it is written and affords me the ability to carry a firearm from the day of my initial qualification with the academy, in lieu of having to be certified. I was basically asked to come and testify, if necessary, with regards to personal examples of both on and off duty incidences that required me, well, not necessarily required me, but that I benefited from the ability to have been armed, and then, of course, the ability to continue to carry a firearm after retirement due to the fact that I've lived in served for the last 15 years, and while unfortunate, I have had issues outside of work with my family members present that I feel personally, had I not had a firearm, or had the offender not thought that I maybe possibly had a firearm, that those incidences could have become a lot worse. I will forego the stories unless anyone wants to hear them, and just say that I adamantly support this bill, and was really surprised to find, after 14 years in law enforcement, that members of the law enforcement community that went out into the public and put themselves in harm's way were not being allowed to carry firearms in the process.
All right, thank you. Question, Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I always wanted to ask this question because I never knew the answer. No, I will. How do we know who's retired? I know in the concealed weapons system, you know, like automatically comes up on the sheriff's report, so you know who that is. But how do we know who's retiring, who's not, so who gets charged, who doesn't get charged?
Yes, Chair and Senator Boquist. The State Police Academy, or otherwise known as DPSSST, there's a retirement process where you actually have to remain qualified with the department that you were employed with, and you maintain your State Academy number. So just as if I were pulled over for a traffic citation now, the law enforcement or patrol officer that pulled me over would see, one, that I am certified in the state of Oregon, and two, that I have a DPSST number, and to make that assumption that I may or may not have a firearm in the vehicle with me. At the time of retirement, you're issued an honorary identification card, and you have to maintain, and I'm sorry, I don't know what the statute says off the top of my head, you have to maintain a certain level of qualification through that department or the academy to continue to maintain that firearm.
Yeah, and I can just follow up on that. EPD, Eugene Police Department, the person that kind of is the, I'm going to call him the godfather of the retirees, sends out notices whenever they're going up for requalifying, and people have to sign up for it. So there is a process that's done. Any other questions? Senator Wilson.
Mr. Chair, have the counties weighed in on this as far as we're sort of preempting their authority here? Have the counties weighed in on this bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yeah, actually on the House side, they did read the bill. They had no problem with it. In fact, the my understanding, the two counties that were reading the statute differently, their county council, in fact, were encouraging us to put this bill forward so that it actually gave them flexibility to go ahead and arm people when they had qualified rather than waiting for full certification.
Thank you.
All right, any other comments? Now, let me see if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on 2789A. Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on the bill. Open the work session on House Bill 2789A.
Mr. Chair, move HB 2789A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2789A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So order. Chair will carry this one. We'll close the public the work session on House Bill 2789A. And I see the good Representative Barton is here, but I thought he wasn't going to be testifying again. Are you coming back to testify? You're just sitting here.
He likes meeting with him.
I don't know if you can get CLEs today, but we'll see if we can qualify you for one or two. All right, with that, we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing, which is House Bill 2968A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2968A allows the Oregon Department of Transportation to reschedule an implied consent hearing if the person's attorney is ill or has a scheduling conflict, provides that the hearing may be rescheduled only one time for this purpose, and that the hearing must be set within 14 days of the original hearing date. There's no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, and no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you, John. Come on up. Was there anyone else who was going to give testimony on 2968A?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Henry Hinkson III. I'm a country lawyer from Boring, Oregon, which happens to be the district of Representative Barton. I would like to speak to you about the past, the present, and the future. In implied consent proceedings in the past, if a lawyer was ill or had a scheduling conflict, without legislative or administrative rule authority, the Department of Motor Vehicles would accommodate the conflict in the calendar of the attorney and reschedule the hearing for a later time, but on the condition that the license had to go into a suspension mode. So the public interest in making sure that a suspected drunk driver was off the road was fully satisfied. This was the practice for, I didn't start a time clock on this, but it's been at least 10 or 15 years. Well, then because of advanced age, I had to have a knee replaced, and I requested some four hearings to be rescheduled with the suspension going into effect so that my clients could enjoy their right to counsel of choice. So I requested that the hearings be scheduled before my operation, and they were unable to do it. So they scheduled them for 7 and 10 days after I'd undergone surgery, when I was totally unable to practice law. As a result, I had to get another attorney to cover those hearings for me, and my clients were denied the right to counsel of their choice. This is the occasion for this bill, and it's not just about me. It's about all lawyers, and more importantly, it's about all citizens who choose a lawyer to represent them at an administrative proceeding that proposes to take their license to drive away. So that's the reason why this particular piece of legislation is before you. The administrative law requires that there be the appearance as well as the actuality of fairness in these proceedings, and I believe that the passage of this bill will restore the public confidence in the administrative process. I should also say that I quite frankly agree with the Department of Motor Vehicles' position that they did not have authority to continue these proceedings. They did it out of graciousness, I believe, for many, many years. But as a matter of strict administrative law, unless an agency is given authority by this body, by the legislature of Oregon, the administrative agency does not have power, because the presumption is in favor of no authority and has to be given by this body. So I request that you strongly consider passage of this bill, because it brings us back to the future. In other words, the past, when the Department of Motor Vehicles was permitted to grant these suspensions to go into effect, but the person could have a hearing later, will be now the future, going back to the past. And it was fair then, and it should be fair today.
Thank you. Questions? I think that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the honor of appearing before you.
You bet. Was anyone else, again, who wanted to give testimony on 2968? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2968A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2968A to the floor with a due pass.
All right. Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2968A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Just yes. A comment, Mr. Chair. I mean, the illness, not challenged at all by that, but I see vacation and scheduling conflict, and I'm not sure how DMV is going to figure that one out, but I'll support the bill.
I assume what they'll do is that the attorney will report to the department one of those reasons, and because they can only do this once, that will be the end of it. And they also now, under the A and Gross, do have that limitation of the 45 days. I'm supportive of the bill as well. Since the suspension still goes into effect, and does appear that this is an opportunity to allow the person to have whoever they have hired to be there for them at that hearing. Any other discussions? Any objection? So ordered. And let's see here.
Chair will carry this one.
And we're going to go ahead and open up the next public hearing, which is on House Bill 2972.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2972 shifts the burden of proof to the offender to prove that he or she meets the requirements to be relieved from reporting as a sex offender, provides the victim of the offense may testify voluntarily at the hearing or under subpoena if issued under a court order, declares emergency, effective on passage, no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, and no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Doug? Chair Posansky, members of the committee, my name's Doug Harkelrode. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney, and I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. This bill comes to you today because an assistant district attorney, Brendan Murphy, ran into a case in Marion County where a young lady, not yet 30, had been sexually assaulted over 10 years ago. And she was being contacted by a defense attorney to get her to come in and testify. I learned of that, and I ended up representing the young lady on a voluntary basis to provide a little screen for her. In essence, what we figured out is that 10 years later, the state had the burden of proof to prove that he wasn't eligible. And we also figured out that she had no protection and could be subpoenaed in just to testify, regardless of whether or not she had anything probative to offer. And the other thing was, is this a criminal case or is this a civil case? And there was some question about that. There was actually litigation on that particular issue. So this bill fixes those three things. It changes the burden of proof, and it puts it on the person who is requesting relief from registration. It also protects the victim from having to testify unless a court determines that she has good reason to be called as a witness. It doesn't preclude her from being called. It just puts the buffer of the court in there to make that initial decision. And it makes it part of the criminal case. So we all know whether it's criminal or civil. Pretty simple bill. When we ran into this problem, I contacted Representative Barton, who was kind enough to apply his staff resources, and we worked out this bill, and it's in front of you today. That's all I have.
All right, thank you. Steve?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Dole, Crime Victims United of Oregon. I'll make my comments brief. Crime Victims United is in support of House Bill 2972 for the following reasons. It gives the victim peace of mind, and it also ensures the victim's safety and security. How does it do this? It gives the victim peace of mind in the fact that, as Mr. Harkerode mentioned, that they only have to come in front of the testify if the offender can demonstrate good cause by showing that the victim's testimony is material and favorable to the person's request for relief. So it has to go through a judge, and the judge has to make that determination. And this I thought this looked familiar to me because this was in a bill that we crafted in 2007 and was in front of this committee regarding post-conviction relief, and I think most of you remember that bill. It balances the rights of the victim with the rights of the offenders, and last but not least, it provides for the safety and security of the victim by allowing the victim, if they want to appear electronically through a video or a telephone when they testify. So we are in support of the bill, and we thank you for your time and attention.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Thanks a lot.
Mr. Chairman, I
have a question. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad you mentioned, Mr. Dole, the 2007 bill, because I had a constituent who came in with her son who was caught up in the whole situation because of a lack of consent. It was a high school situation. And it's my understanding, I support this bill, but I'm a little bit concerned because she emailed me during the interim and said that they were having trouble. They didn't expect that it would be so difficult to go through this process. Do you anticipate that this will be make it harder for people in that situation whom the bill was intended to address?
I'll defer to Mr. Harkerode on that.
Chair Prozanski, Senator Bonamici, I don't think it'll make it any harder. The changing of the burden of proof, the things that you have to prove are pretty static, and so they don't change much over time. So the factual presentation, I don't think, is going to be a big problem for anybody. And it really shouldn't be any harder for somebody to get relief from registration. This bill was initially designed to take care of those reasonably close in age
right.
issues, as you'll recall. And so it shouldn't be a problem there, I don't think.
Any other questions, comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Gail Meyer, and was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on 2972?
Thank you, Chair Pozanski and members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'd like to take this opportunity to explain the reasons why OCDLA is neutral on the bill. and some of it relates to the question just posed by Senator Bonamici. There are two statutes relating to getting relief from having to register as a sex offender. One of them has very fluid and amorphous factors. It relates to whether or not they're variable factors, whether or not the defendant's been rehabilitated and whether or not he poses a threat to the safety of the public. But this bill does not affect that statute. The other basis upon which one can seek relief from registering as a sex offender is the 2007 legislation. And just as Mr. Harkelrode said, those are very static facts. As a matter of fact, the defendant has to allege them in the petition to even qualify for relief. Were you convicted of a particular offense? Was there a particular age difference between the offender and the victim? And was lack of consent due to the fact solely because of age? Because these are really static facts, and because the defendant has to allege them affirmatively anyway in the initiating petition, we really don't think it nets that much functional difference in the courtroom as to really who bears the burden of proof. A lot of that is just a matter of record. So that's why we're neutral on this bill. If there were an effort next session to change the burden of proof on the other bill, you'll hear from us in opposition to that. As to the provisions for calling the victim, I think it's highly unusual to think that you would call a victim in a petition of this nature, but I do think that these provisions don't really offend us that much, with the exception simply of subsection D, which is that if the court grants an order allowing a subpoena under this subsection, the court may allow the victim to appear by telephone or other communication device approved by the court. We just note that when you do carry the burden of proof, nothing beats live testimony of the witness. It's the only way for the judge to make a real credibility finding. So we don't like subsection D of the witness provision, but in other respects, we're neutral on the bill.
All right. Any questions? Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the level of burden of proof required here?
I believe by statute it's preponderance of evidence.
All right. The only thing I'm going to just put on the record, Gail, based on your statements for that section or subsection D, it does allow the court, in other words, it's optional, and so the court would have the authority and maintain the authority to require the victim to appear in person if he or she, meaning the judge, chose that would be more appropriate. All right. Any other comments? And if not, then we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2972 and open a work session on House Bill 2972.
Chair, move HB 2972 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2972 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So order. Chair will carry this one. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2972. And we're opening up our last of our public hearings on House Bill 2137A.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 2137A limits disclosure of public protected health, mental health, financial substantiated abuse, and legal information of elderly or disabled individuals in court protective proceedings, allows disclosure by the Department of Human Services if made in good faith and is reasonably necessary to prevent or lessen a serious and imminent threat to the health and safety of the person subjected to the protective order. It requires confidential information to be sealed by the court. There are two amendments in front of the committee today, the A4 and A5 amendments. The A4 amendment and the A5 amendment are identical, except that the Department of Justice has added some language to the A5 amendment. I believe the proponents of the bill will be describing these amendments more fully, but the committee should know that the A5 amendment is our legislative council says the A5 amendment is ambiguous, and they recommend the A4 amendment. So.
Okay. All right. So I've got Mary Gear that's coming up for DHS. Also, George, why don't you come up? Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on 2137A? If not, Mary, sign in and give us your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Pozanski and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Beer. I'm the administrator for the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care in the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities Division. Among other things, my office is responsible for the program and policy operation of adult protective services across the state for people who are seniors and people with physical disabilities. I'm happy to be here this morning to testify in support of House Bill 2137A as amended, and I'll talk about the amendments. This is a bill that was submitted by the governor at the request of the department. There's two primary issues that we were seeking to address with this bill. One is that it would allow our adult protective services workers to petition the court for a protective order. Currently, APS workers are not allowed to petition the court and so often are in a position of needing to find someone who will do that on behalf of an individual. And there may or may not be someone who is available to do that, especially for our clients who do not have personal funds in order to be able to pay for someone to represent them. And so as a consequence, sometimes vulnerable adults are left in potentially abusive situations, and so we'd like to remedy that. The second thing that we're wanting to remedy is currently Adult Protective Services doesn't have the clear authority to share information about APS findings with the court when there is a protective proceeding. And so we've been in a position where someone who we have substantiated for financial abuse, for example, may be seeking to become the conservator for an individual. And we don't have clear authority to share our finding with the court in that situation to let them know that we have some concerns about that individual. Excuse me. So this change to the statute would give APS that clear authority to share information with the court. The House Human Services Committee amended the bill and was very thoughtful in agreeing to move the bill through to the Senate. We did note that when it came to the Senate that there were some clarifications that needed to be done about sharing confidential information once it entered the court system. And so that's the -4 and the -5 amendments that you have in front of you. These amendments were a very collaborative effort with the Department of Justice, the Judicial Department, Disability Rights of Oregon, and the Elder Law Section of the Bar. And it is the department and our stakeholders' preference for the -5 amendments over the -4 amendments. What we were seeking to do in these amendments was to clarify how the confidential and protected information would be transferred from the department into the courts, how and with whom the information could be shared once it enters the court system. And we also inserted an emergency clause, which we failed to do the first time around, and so it would become effective upon passage of the bill. So I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have. As I say, we prefer the -5 amendments with the added language from the Department of Justice and supported by our stakeholders. We can certainly live with the -4.
All right, George, before you give your testimony, Mayor, I just want to put on the record so we can look at this while George is testifying. The only change I see is on page 2 on the -5s, line 9 and 10 being added. Was there something else that was changed besides adding that sub 6?
Chair Pozanski, if I may, if you look at the -4, sub 5 is the same as sub 6 in the -5.
Oh, okay.
So the changes are sub 5.
And sub 5 was
6 through 8.
Gotcha, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Line 6.
Okay. All right. Thank you for the clarification, George.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is George Okuvich, here on behalf of Disability Rights Oregon. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2137, the A engrossed, and also supporting the -5 amendments. We believe this bill goes a long way to protecting vulnerable Oregonians, and it does so in a way that protects their right of privacy and due process. As counsel noted, we believe we sort of concur, I guess, with LC in that both the -4 and the -5 amendment essentially do the same thing, but we believe because you're dealing with you know, this incredible waiver of confidentiality. It would be best to probably use the dash fives to recite sort of the rules of evidence. So just between the two, that's where Disability Rights Oregon is, and we urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Question for either panelist. Senator Wissett.
Chair Przanski, does this just involve a physical abuse, or is it also verbal abuse and financial abuse?
Chair Przanski and Senator Wissett, abuse has a broad definition in Oregon law, so it's financial, physical, sexual, emotional, potentially. So it's a and also includes neglect.
Yes, go ahead.
Then, pursuant to our conversation the other day, someone in the care of a developmentally disabled adult were to borrow 75 cents from them to help defray the cost of buying them a Coke, that would be considered abuse by the Department of Human Services, and it would be a confidential abuse. It would be held confidential.
Senator Wittsett, I just want to be clear about the population that this particular statute refers to. This is seniors and people with physical disabilities. It is not individuals with developmental disabilities, and that is a separate section of statute.
Okay.
So there are abuse definitions for those two populations that are similar but a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And so the financial exploitation area is one of those that's a little bit different between those two areas, those two populations. So the example that you gave involved an individual with developmental disabilities. If your question is, in that situation, if it was a senior, say, it is possible that an individual who used the client's money to buy something for themselves, regardless of the amount of that money, would be substantiated for abuse. It would depend on the circumstances around it, but that is a possibility.
Follow up, please.
Yes.
Then abuse is pretty much whatever is defined by the Department of Human Services as abuse.
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Wittsett, there is a statutory definition of abuse. There is interpretation by the department about levels of abuse and what's considered abuse and what's an abusive situation. And as we discussed last week, it has to do with the imbalance of power of a caregiver who has power over someone that they're providing care for, and in some situations has the ability to significantly injure or cause death of that individual with neglecting them or withholding care.
Then within those rules, the Department of Human Services could bring a charge of abuse on virtually anything that the Department of Human Services felt was abusive, regardless of what is in statute, and it would be up to the individual to determine that the individual and the court to determine that it wasn't. Is that correct?
Chair Przanski and Senator Wittsett, the department determines abuse based on statute and the rules that we've promulgated.
Your interpretation of statute.
And the interpretation of statute, yes, Senator, that we promulgate them through rules. And there is a rulemaking process that requires public hearings and stakeholder input and those kinds of things. I would also add that in situations where there's a finding of abuse against an individual who works in a facility like a foster home or an assisted living facility or a nursing home, that facility has the right to a contested case hearing when there's a sanction placed against them. So there is a due process that's allowed for finding of abuse.
I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Other questions, comments? All right, thank you very much for coming forward. We're going to go ahead and close our public hearing on House Bill 2137A. Open a work session on House Bill 2137A.
Hey, Mr. Chair, so what's the difference between the 4 and the 5?
The difference between the 4s and 5s is when you look at the 5s, there's a
page 2,
lines 6 through 8. That's sub 5. And it basically says there that nothing in this section pertaining to the what would be in the law is intended to limit the application, it says, of RS 125.050, which counsel is showing you is basically the application of the evidence code and
Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure,
yeah.
ORCP.
ORCP.
Basically, that's the discovery.
And what legal counsel is saying lines 6 through 8 are
Yeah, counsel, why don't you read?
Well, legislative council sent a letter saying they did not think that that section was necessary to be put into the amendments because and thought that was ambiguous, actually putting that in. So they recommend A4. But it is, of course, a committee decision.
Yeah.
And the proponents are recommending A5 because and they want
yeah.
it.
Mr. Chair, I would support the A5 amendment because I think it clarifies, but it's not intended to limit the ORC to that statute that says that the ORCP and the rules of evidence apply. And it says that I think the legislative council opinion says that use of information may be ambiguous, but I think it's pretty clear that it says use of information disclosed under this section. So I don't see the problem with the -5.
And my understanding is that Department of Justice is the ones that suggested that insertion of the sub-5. And maybe within their practice, they feel that for whatever reason, that's going to give more clarity. So if there was a challenge that either of those two other sections, the evidence code or the rules of civil procedure, didn't apply, they do. But, yeah, the uniqueness for me is that I don't know anything in here in this what would be in the -5, 6, lines 9 to 10 that would limit those applications, but if for clarity, if that's what they think they want. So the question, I guess, for us is, do we go with the suggestions of Department of Justice, who is the more on the practitioner side, or do we go with what LC has said? So.
Mr. Chair, I move A5
and then main bill. All right, Senator Boquist moves the -5s into House Bill 2137 A. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, I'm glancing at the LC's opinion. I mean, we're simply inserting the same text of the law in there. And if there's ambiguity in the existing law, then I guess there's going to be ambiguity in the amendments. So,
right. All right, any other comments?
Mr. Chair, I will support the bill today, but with reservation that I might change my vote.
Well, I was actually going to assign the bill to you, so thank you for letting me know.
Mr. Chair.
All right.
Volunteer on the right here.
So, any other comments? Any objection besides the reservation that Senator Wissett has at this point? If not, then so ordered.
Chair, move HB 2137 as amended with the -5 to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Boquist now moves House Bill 2137A, and as amended by the -5s, to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
Sure, just one point of clarification. It's my understanding this covers physical disabilities only, according to the testimony.
That's correct. What we heard.
Thank you.
That's not what.
No, that's not what we heard. What we heard was that it was basically there's a definition, but then there's interpretations or the rules that are made, and it goes broader than that.
Physical, financial, verbal,
yes. Right.
Any kind of abuse that the Department of Human Services
yes.
considers
much
abuse.
Broader than just physical.
Right.
All right. Okay. Any other discussion? Any objection? Again, Senator Wissett reserves his right to change his position on the bill before it comes to the floor, and with that. Orders approved. It goes to the floor. And Senator Dingfelder is going to be our carrier on this one. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2137A. And now we're into our work sessions. And let me do one thing. All right, so I'm going to open up our first work session. This is going to be House Bill 2987A. And the purpose for opening up that work session is basically to move the bill out of our committee, which was, let's say, misassigned, so it can go back to the President's office, so it can be assigned, I believe, to Human Services, or one of the two health committees.
So moved, whatever you said, Mr. Chair.
Right. Senator Boquist moves that we send House Bill 2987A back to the President's office for reassignment or referral based on their request that we do so. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2987A. Open the work session on House Bill 2687A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2687A provides the rules for funds resulting from settlements or judgments involving minors for amounts less than $25,000. We heard this on May 18th. It's got no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact, no amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2687A to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2687A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Just clarification. I think we heard it on the 11th.
I'm sorry. Today's the 18th. It's the 11th. Sorry.
I know we heard
May 11th.
Okay. All right. Any other points? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Wissett, will you carry this one? Senator Wissett will be our carrier on House Bill 2787A. And we'll close the work session on that bill. And we'll open up our work session on House Bill 3111A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We heard House Bill 3111A on May 11th. Changes the award of attorney fees from prevailing party to prevailing plaintiff in unlawful trade practices cases. There's no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, and no amendment.
All right. Mr. Chair, move HB 3111A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 3111A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Questions, comments? All right. Objection. No discussion. Then I'm going to say any objection.
I object.
All right. Senator Wissett objects. Anyone else with that? We'll go ahead and so ordered. And Senator Dingfelder, will you be our carrier on this one?
I prefer not because I did miss the hearing.
Okay. The chair will carry 3111A. And we'll close the work session on that. And then we're going to open up our last work sessions for today, House Bill 2584A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2584A, we heard on May 11th as well. It allows a plaintiff to bring an antitrust lawsuit if they are an indirect purchaser. It is the Illinois brick repealer case bill. No revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, and no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you
want to
make a motion? I might want
to. Okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2584A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 2584A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, I'm still kind of reviewing this, so I'll vote no in the committee and then make my determination as I get closer to the floor and have a little bit more time to catch up.
Okay. Any other comments?
I will be voting no.
All right. Besides the two objections, any other objections? So order, and Senator Boamici, will you be our carrier on this one?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2584A. And Council, what else, if anything?
I think that we got through everything.
All right. So, committee, thank you very much. We are scheduled to start at 8 tomorrow. And with that, we're closed. Our adjourn until then.